Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Raising Ollie, How My Non-Binary Art Nerd Kid Changed Nearly Everything I Know, by Tom Rademacher, narrated by Roger Wayne. Introduction. The Many Stories of Olive. We are a family of story hoarders. The things we hang on our walls and display on our shelves are pieces of stories. Things we couldn't sell if we wanted to, and yet would be the first things grabbed if there were a fire. There's the small business card-sized sign that says, "Cigar and smoking in the cognac room only, please," from the restaurant Becca and I went to on our first big dating anniversary, still both in our teenage years. It was a place full of young people doing something fancy, and older people out for the kind of dinner you go to with a jacket on. Maybe get a steak and a few drinks. We stole the sign as our own little rebellion against the idea of going to a place like this and doing things like anniversary dinners. We were especially quirky hypocrites like that, the kind who did all the normal things ironically and still managed to do all the normal things. There's the bright green painting with purple and blue lines and geometric shapes. Not the kind of thing we'd be into, except that this one thing is from a road trip to New York. One where our car broke in Pennsylvania and exhaust poured in through the air vents. And we got to a hotel off the highway and I promptly passed out, nearly green from breathing it in. And where Becca took a walk and got lost. But also somewhere in there found someone to come get the car. And the next day we went and talked to him, understanding very little of his thick rural Pennsylvania accent, except that there was a cheap option to just weld a thing that was, you know, not totally legal and wouldn't hold forever, or we could wait a few days for a part and pay four times as much. And seeing as we were crossing the state line that day, off we went in less than an hour. None of that is even the story. We got the painting because we got to New York and Becca tracked down a guy who once knew her uncle before he died, and he had that painting in his back room, having hung on to it after her uncle's death just in case he ever met just the right person who should have it. That's the story. There are many shrines to my dad hidden all over the house. A set of beer glasses over here, this one book on the shelf, the watch on the nightstand, a little engraved pocket knife in the desk drawer. There are all the typewriters, all with stories. My grandpa's shiny black Remington with the extra long register, because he was an engineer who needed to fit blueprints. My great aunt's portable, a light gray Royal that clips firmly inside its own small case. That went with her to Korea and Vietnam, where she was stationed as a nurse. My great-grandma Marie's, an olive-green Elsie Smith secretarial, the typewriter of the first writer I know of in the family, who got married in secret so great-grandpa Paul could go fight in World War I, and she could stay and keep teaching, because married women weren't allowed to, and who wrote poems and fiery letters to the editor and little stories that the paper wouldn't publish until she started writing as P.V. Canthook, a local lumberjack. A binder of all her writing is downstairs, her own hoard of stories about Paul Bunyan that are half fables of the North Woods and half love letters to her husband. I've inherited those love letters from her, and maybe also an instinct to write them. My first book was a love letter, and this book, even more so. There's pictures, of course. Nothing professional, though. No matching denim whatever and a painted sign that says love. Instead, we have poorly taken selfies from before cameras had screens, half my face cut off on a water taxi in Sweden, everything from the nose down on both of us in Alaska, dirty and miserable and pretending to be happy that one time we went to Burning Man in the deserts of Nevada. And at our wedding, holding plastic umbrellas because the outdoor ceremony was rained out, and we did the whole damn thing in a place that looked like a gymnatorium. But let us bring in our own beer. Our house was full, we thought, of all these little stories that together hold a life of stories together. It was full, the life and the house. And then we had Ollie, and everything got somehow more full. I want to tell you stories. I want to tell you all the stories. But all the stories aren't mine, and all the stories aren't for you. There's a bunch of stories, though, many focused on this one pretty big year for my family that I can share, that I'm excited to share. Like most real stories, there aren't perfect beginnings or middles or, most especially, endings. There was no clear thesis statement for any year of my life or for any chapter of this book. But there are stories. Stories do seem to say something when they are told all together. If I've ever taken you on a tour of my house, I'm sorry. You know that I can't tell you just one of the stories, just part of the stories. I can't tell you about the typewriters without bringing out the story binder. But those don't make real sense without the pictures of Paul's regiment, which are hung by Becca's uncle's painting and that portrait of Becca our high school art teacher painted of her as the stepmother in Cinderella, as a set piece the summer of her junior year that we hung above our fireplace as a joke and then realized it was perfect. Piece by piece, these stories build our home. I can't tell you about raising Olive without telling you about my dad. Can't tell you about him without explaining how his illness was gasoline poured on the fire of my college-aged anxiety. I can't talk about how funny Olive is without showing you how much fun Ollie and Becca and I all have together. How, second to stories, we are a family of inside jokes and shared laughter. To tell you the story of raising Olive, I have to tell you so many stories. These stories are satellites, orbiting each other, taking their turns in the center because the physics of stories is like that. There are the stories that started this, the bits of my childhood that have clumped together, large enough to create some kind of gravity. Stories are added from the first lurching attempts at adulthood, and lost as the whole mess keeps floating wherever it's going through the cold chaos of space. They are, all these stories now, orbiting and pushing and pushed by the mass in the middle, this thing whose speed and the weight of its importance make it shine, burning with brilliant white light. It's this most important thing I've ever done, the most important thing I'll ever do, so much that its light is changing, slightly but permanently, every other story that surrounds it. These are the stories, piece by piece, that make this book. Piece by piece, these are the stories of raising Ollie. And also, not to be dramatic or anything, but writing often feels like I have cut a piece of myself out from just under my ribs and nailed it to a wall, then sat back and listened to people react to it while I bleed out slowly onto the floor. Not to be dramatic. Writing this book has been a lot different and a lot more challenging than the teaching stuff I usually write because I've been cutting that piece out of my family, not just myself. It's tricky work and has at times made every member of my family less than super comfortable or happy. There have been long conversations about what stories to include and how to protect everyone. What I mean to say is, I share a lot about my family in this book, but you don't get everything. Because they are more important to me than you are. I did my best to tell the stories that are mine or from my point of view. That goes for family stories, but also personal and teaching stories. You don't get everything. I'm a writer. I'd rather tell you everything. My wife is a therapist, which means that she, in a lot of ways, is a professional secret keeper. Her work is rooted in the protection of privacy. She'd much rather I was a writer about dragons and stuff. We aren't a perfect family, and I think you'll see that here, but I haven't, just to make us more human and relatable, included any stories that would be deeply embarrassing or damaging, especially to Olive as they grow up. So some stories got cut because I needed more time away from them before I could see their shape, or because I couldn't tell them without revealing stuff we didn't want to put in a book forever and ever. Sometimes I change names or other details to protect identities or melded a few people into one person or something like that. I didn't make up anything from scratch, though. The essential bits are essentially true. You just don't get everything. April. School trouble. When our daughter Olive was 7, Becca and I found out that they were probably smarter than we are. I mean, we had a pretty good idea they were pretty smart, but 7 was when we started hearing it from professionals. I remember walking out of the first meeting, the word gifted was used. It was said by a psychologist who had just finished testing Ollie, who had then taken us through the results while using phrases like off the charts. I walked to the car thinking to myself, God damn, we're screwed. Sometimes while we're driving, Ollie will let out a noise. I can't spell it, except to say it somewhere between the noise of an exclamation mark and the look in someone's eye when they know for certain they're about to vomit. As parents, of course, Becca and I are always instantly alarmed and do a split-second audit of any plastic bags we may have on the floor. But no, it's not usually anything physically wrong. The thing that bothers Ollie that severely is when they see, of all things, bad graphic design. We have a game when we go into a store of trying to find the absolute worst logo we can. Ollie has this incredible artist's eye for color and proportion, and also a nerd's eye for font and clip art usage. "That's the same font the tire store uses," they'll say, pointing at some off-brand juice, and they'll be right. "But it looks better for the juice," they'll continue, and they'll be right again. Then they'll find some truly terrifying picture of a dog with human teeth smiling and say, "Oh God," as if someone just fell down the stairs in a way that looked painful, but then into a mud pit in a way that looked funny. They'll demand we take a picture of the human-mouthed dog, go home, and Photoshop it into a family photo. Ask us, please, pretty please, to frame it. We will not, but it will live on the refrigerator for a time, a memory of that one time we all laughed so loud at the grocery store we got shushed. Olive, by the way, prefers the term daughter, is non-binary, and uses they-them pronouns, and has been called Ollie or Olive interchangeably since they were a baby. Olive also prefers art to athletics, vegetables to cake, and animals to most humans. They're a bright kid who has loved school since day one, but who learns ferociously and naturally and constantly, mostly when they're anywhere but the actual school they go to every day to learn stuff. For a lot of reasons, I really love the school Ollie goes to. It is diverse in a way that few schools in my city are, in a way that there is no racial majority in the school. And that means my daughter learns with and from kids who are recent immigrants and refugees who speak many languages and celebrate different holidays. Sure, there are a white kid whose closest friends are other white kids, but a few days ago we were watching Oliver, because their weird, mostly white kid choir is singing a song from it, and as we watched the scene where they were doling out gruel for the orphans, Ollie mentioned that the gruel looked like it had gelatin in it, which would mean any Muslim orphans wouldn't be able to eat it. So there's something they learned at school. Not only that, but a fact about a culture other than theirs, and that they learned not just from classmates, but from their first grade teacher, who was from that culture, so that the information came with empathy. There are reasons I love their school. In a lot of ways, though, I'm not so happy with Ollie's school. They've loved every teacher they've had and have been loved by them, but budget cuts and lack of support are hurting the kids there. Ollie tells me about how the whole second grade lunch only has one adult present, so on the day I sent them with stuff in a Tupperware they couldn't open, they didn't really eat because no one could help them. Ollie says that bullying and behavior are problems, but because the teachers are left alone to deal with it, their focus is mainly on keeping order, which means the kids that get bullied often don't get helped. The students who most need attention and support aren't getting it until something big happens, which makes life harder for everyone. Then it is mainly a process of removal and timeouts and not addressing root causes or others impacted or anything that will really make it any better the next time. As a teacher, I get it. I've taught kids with pretty severe behavior issues. I've had times when I taught class in a hallway because a student was screaming and throwing things inside my room. As a teacher, I was glad that kid was back in my room the next week, was able to keep trying and keep growing. That my other students got to know that student as a brilliant dancer, as wickedly funny, as able to answer any question a teacher had, but only as a response to being accused of not paying attention. As a parent, when Ollie came home one day in first grade with a spot on their arm from being stabbed with a pencil, which they got for standing up for a friend who was being called words that even I'm not old enough to say yet, it feels different. Their first grade teacher did everything they could to take care of all those kids physically, emotionally, and intellectually, but you know, on days when kids are getting stabbed, there's likely to be less learning. By the next year, things were getting worse. Ollie came home with stories of kids throwing desks and chairs, of calls to the office gone unanswered, as teachers struggled to handle everything alone. More and more, Ollie ended up in a corner with a book or an extra packet of worksheets, and their love of school turned to a sharp fear of the mixture of boredom and chaos of most days. Because Ollie was identified as an advanced learner in kindergarten, they're supposed to get an hour a week with a specialist doing advanced learnery stuff. But that person seems to be called into meetings more often than not, and so can't make it. Every year seems to bring more budget cuts, more schools asked to do more with less. Also, both administrators in the building have awful reputations in the district and have been kicked around from job to job for years. I've worked with one before and was very unimpressed with, well, her basic ability to do anything. The other administrator has been described to me as batshit crazy by no fewer than 5 different people in the district in separate conversations. So that's cool. But all schools have their shit. I get that. I'm also finely attuned to the shit that my kid has to walk into every day. Also, more than any of that, maybe the biggest problem we have with the school for our kid is that Ollie is bored. Excruciatingly bored. This kid is really smart. Ollie's test scores are all in the top 1% of students nationally. They read and write at a level that would be passable in most middle school classrooms and, for fun, has been learning Japanese and Spanish on Duolingo while teaching themselves to code, write, and record music, and edit video. We do not push Ollie to do these things. In fact, we mainly wish they would chill out now and again. But that's just not their brain. So Ollie's bored when school is lots of worksheets and listening, and still bored when the stuff for the high group kids is just slightly harder worksheets and listening. Bored enough that Ollie came home from school a few weeks ago and started researching advanced school programs in our area while I was making us dinner. Because every second grader does that, right? Becca asked them what a perfect school would look like, and Ollie said, "One where I got to learn all day. That would be amazing." That's a pretty low bar for any school anywhere, but one that Ollie spoke about with such longing that Becca started researching too. So, well, shit. Now it gets difficult. Here I thought my daughter was just a mostly sweet 7-year-old who likes video games and excruciatingly obnoxious YouTubers. Now I find out that Ollie's actually a neoliberal corporate edu-reformer bent on the destruction of public schools by weaponizing school choice. I should have known when Ollie threw out their American Girl doll and replaced it with small stuffed versions of Bill Gates, Betsy DeVos, and Michelle Rhee. Started giving standardized tests to their guinea pig and doing random parent quality assessments of me. Needs improvement. I sat Ollie down and said to them, "Look, kiddo, I understand you wanting to choose a school that would be better for you, especially when yours isn't so great, but if you keep talking about it, people are going to hate your daddy forever and ever." Ollie cried and cried. But they'll get over it, eventually. Okay, that didn't happen. Still, for someone who has often been pretty open to students and families getting to choose schools that are good for them, I've still been feeling pangs of guilt when I think about ditching the district we live in just for the little silly reason that it is making my daughter miserable. There are a lot of things. Sure, Ollie thrives on challenging stuff and chances to think creatively and critically, but they also need adults and kids around them that understand how they think big and feel big and worry big and dream big and work big, and how sometimes doing all those things at top speed all at once can lead to big crashes. They need a school that works to affirm their identity without making it look like work. A school that keeps Ollie safe while exposing them to new ideas, new kinds of people, and places, and beliefs. Thankfully, for us and for Ollie, those places exist. Unfortunately, they aren't everywhere, and getting kids properly identified and given access to those places is not a thing we, as a whole educational system, do in a really equitable way. We found a school for Ollie, and of course, they take up a lot of the worry space in my head because they are my kid. But the process of getting Ollie to the right school and what that has meant for their intellectual growth and their happiness and health have me thinking not just about Ollie, but about all the kids out there who aren't getting that chance. About all the kids I've had and will have in my own classroom who could use some of what Ollie needs. About how I may have failed to really teach or challenge Ollie if they were in my class. About how to build a room and practice that wouldn't fail in those ways. I mean, I hate to be the guy that's like, "Wow, being a parent really changed me as a teacher." Because I remember hearing that over and over again while I was coming up as a teacher. I remember feeling that what everyone meant was that I couldn't know what it meant to really care about kids until I had my own. Now I don't think that's exactly it. It's not so much what you learn about kids as what you learn about yourself. Being a dad has made me a better person. Being an Olive dad, specifically, has made me think so much harder about who I am for the kids in my room and what they need from me. Put most simply, there is nothing that has been more impactful and inspiring and important to me as a teacher than raising Olive. May, the music teacher. There are a few things we can get Ollie to voluntarily leave the house for. Bubble tea is the most successful and is often used as a reward or bribe for less pleasurable things. Pokemon Go worked, like it did for the rest of the world, as a reason to actually go on a walk where there are trees and people and stuff. Then, like the rest of the world, the allure wore off, and we were back to bubble tea, swimming, and choir practice. Though I can't promise I was any level of excited when we signed Ollie up for weekly choir practices on nights that I was the only parent home to take them, I do love that our kid loves music. They got this love, and no doubt any aptitude for it, from Becca. The first few years of baby having were a constant panic attack on my part. The Olive birth story is also the story of me falling apart and, at times, needing more nurse support than the freshly born baby or the woman who just freshly birthed, without any medication, a baby so big they didn't fit into newborn-sized diapers. I particularly remember one nurse yelling, "Uh-oh, Dad's gone white," and then I don't remember a lot after that, for, like, a month. I'm not proud. I struggled in those early months and years to enjoy much of parenting beyond putting stupid outfits on the kid and having a reason to leave every social obligation early. I've never been less in control of anything in my life than I was with an infant who often decided to do super dumb things like not eat enough or get enough sleep, which are its only two jobs. Becca worked at night, starting shortly after my school day ended, so I had to leave work early, race home, high-five Becca on her way out the door, and spend the evening with this impossible baby that felt like a never-ending emergency. Becca, of course, was doing the same and opposite, and sleeping less because we kept pretending she could nap with Ollie during the day, and so she did more of the nighttime stuff. I remember one of those nights trying to put Olive down to sleep and then needing to change a diaper, but then realizing they needed a bath and new pajamas and then the diaper, and being halfway through that and hearing the dog barking from the backyard but not wanting to pull Ollie out of the water and obviously unable to leave Ollie in the water alone, just trying to hurry, getting Ollie dried and dressed and back in their crib with the dog barking and barking and barking, and when I finally got to the back door to let the dog in, she wouldn't come. I stood in the doorway, shirt and pants wet from the bath and working on maybe 5 hours of sleep in the past 3 nights and having just taught all day and calling for the dog who wouldn't come, and then Olive started crying again, wet sobbing wails, and the dog still wouldn't come, and I sat down. Right there on the landing of the back door, just sat on the floor without the mental or physical strength to do anything else. I just sat there crying. Except that Ollie was crying, and you don't get to give up like that when your child is crying, so I mentally scheduled my giving up for an hour or so in the future, closed the door, and walked back to Ollie's room. I picked him up, tried to rock them back to sleep, just as the dog started barking at the back door again. That was one night, but really it was kind of how the whole first year felt for me. One thing so beautiful that it always paused my permanent feeling panic state was listening to Becca sing to Ollie. She would fill the house with her voice, often singing Nico Case, and though I could hear it from the living room, I would get up to stand just outside of Ollie's room to listen. I worked a bit on my own rendition of Pure Imagination from Willy Wonka, but I could tell Ollie, even as an infant, was doing little more than waiting until I would stop. The first few months of Olive were the most singing I've ever done, and will ever do, and only when alone with a baby. I would rather stand naked in front of a group of strangers than sing in front of them, though most crowds would be equally dismayed and disappointed by either. No, the singing is Becca's, who was a choir superstar when we met in high school. Our principal actually announced the show choir as choir athletes at one pep rally, which shows you just how much our high school cared about and understood the arts. Becca sings in front of people because they ask her to and enjoy it, and she filled our little house with music so beautiful. I often felt a little sad that Ollie and I were the only ones who got to hear. And so it is, that years later, though we can't get Ollie to happily leave the house for parties or ice cream or movies, We often leave for choir practice 40 minutes early because they are so sick of waiting. It's also in a church a block and a half from our house, which means a nice short walk for Ollie to a building without a single comfortable chair for me. But they love it, and I'm willing to put up with America the Beautiful 5 times in a row to let them do this thing they love. The outside of school choir is also why I assumed that the inside of school music class, which is mainly just choir with occasional xylophones, would be one of Ollie's favorite classes. For a time it was, or was at least very close to the top. There were songs about the water cycle in first grade, and how everyone should get along in second. Just every so often, though, a story would trickle in from Ollie about a student being sent out, or the class being yelled at, or made to sit quietly for many minutes. One concert was summarily canceled because the students hadn't done enough, and it never quite got rescheduled. The mid-year concert that wasn't meant that the performance at the end of the year felt pretty extra big. This was around the time that Ollie was struggling most with school. The music teacher doing morning duty often talked to Becca when Ollie was getting dropped off. Drop-offs at that point were accompanied by tears, bargaining, begging. Nearly every morning, Becca would call or text me at work to let me know how it went, to process feeling awful at Ollie's fear and hatred of school. It was a tough, tough year, and sometimes the music teacher would step in and make things a little better for Ollie, telling them about the song they would practice that week or a new instrument they were trying or something. And sometimes they would simply witness, give Becca one of those, "yeah, I know," sort of smiles as she left. Monday night choir was a bright spot, and one of Ollie's best friends from in-school music class was in the same Monday night rehearsals. So I'm sure it was just that they were singing songs from the choir, and I'm sure it was just that they were singing those songs a lot. And I'm sure it's just that they were singing those songs loudly, but one day, one of Ollie's classmates told them that their singing was bad. This is the kind of thing no one likes to hear, but is very much the kind of thing that crawls into Olive's head and sets up shop, burrowing around and knocking stuff over. Like, I guess, a terrifying sandworm shopkeeper? A few days later, Ollie was in music class and didn't want to sing. Couldn't sing. Because every time they opened their mouth, that mean comment from whatever annoyed kid would pulse and throb in Ollie's brain. That's all not wonderful enough. And one would hope, I would hope, that the teacher would notice one of her music-loving students not singing and figure out what was wrong in a helpful, supportive way. But it was only a short time till the final concert, and so I get where maybe that wasn't going to happen. Still, what she didn't have to do was stop the whole rehearsal, single out and embarrass Olive, and send them crying from the room. But that's what she did. It was also even worse than all that. Miss Music Teacher called Ollie out, asked why they weren't singing. When Ollie didn't respond, no doubt terrified as a kid who nearly never got into trouble, Miss Music Teacher kept demanding an answer from Ollie as the whole class looked on. Ollie eventually found a voice to respond, saying softly, "because I'm sad." This is not a bad time for a reminder that this is a 7-year-old kid, a normally not only engaged, but overly enthusiastic participator in Miss Music Teacher's class. "Well," Miss Music Teacher said, using that voice all the kids know is her mean voice, the one she has used to break kids down before, "you control your emotions." She, apparently as someone who has never encountered an emotion, decided to teach Olive. "So you can decide to forget it and not be sad and join us, or you can decide to go, 'wah, wah, I'm Olive and I'm sad,' and not sing." And yes, that whole "wah, wah" part was done in a faux Olive voice and included the teacher miming rubbing her eyes and crying "wah, wah" like a baby. The teacher later denied this part even happened, but other kids the principal talked to who were there backed Ollie up. And also, I trust my kid. Classmates laughed. And the teacher laughed, and then Ollie, previously sad and quiet, started to cry loudly, and then got upset because they were crying in front of their class, which only made them cry harder and harder until they struggled to catch their breath. Miss Music Teacher tried still a little harder to explain to Ollie that they could just decide to relax, to use Ollie as an example to the class that emotions are decisions that are made and can be mastered, that Ollie just didn't want to. Eventually, Miss Music Teacher gave up trying to shame Ollie into breathing, told them to grab a friend and go to the nurse. So Ollie went.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?